Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. This is the Roguecast for Wednesday, September 30th, and as we record this, it is still September, but basically we're heading into October here, folks.
Right.
So we've got a lot of stuff coming up in October. We have our Reading with Rogues, doing Revival over at Mambo House on Tuesday, October 13th.
So it's coming up. You got a couple weeks to read it.
And it's perfect timing for Creepy Halloween.
Yes.
You can pick up Volume 1, Volume 2, or the Volume 1 hardcover, which is our preferred choice because it's awesome.
Even today, I believe somebody purchased a copy of the hardcover.
And then Ladies' Night is going to be October 14th at Palermo's. On October 19th, Monday, we'll be doing our Gaming with Rogues. Forbidden Island will be over at Lamppost Coffee. And as always, folks, on these Gaming and Reading with Rogues, if you get a Rogue card, you get a bonus discount.
That's right.
So keep that in mind. Wizard World will be Friday, October 30th and Saturday, October 31st, a.k.a. Halloween. Dave and I will be down there along with a couple volunteers holding down a booth. We'll have a bunch of stuff to sell.
It'll be a scarifying good time.
It'll be a scarifying good time. And scarifying good time.
Yeah.
No, that's a different thing. Nick will be up here presiding on October 31st over Halloween Comic Fest.
Yes.
And we have a look. The Imprescario.
Imprescario, that was it.
We have a handful of stuff from them today to look over. So among the free comics that will be available, and I just grabbed a handful, like four, is an Ultimate Spider-Man Web Warriors and Avengers Assemble Season 2 giveaway.
Hey, wait, that's not Halloween-themed.
It's not, no.
But that's cool, though. Actually, having some superheroes, especially some all-ages one in the mix, is a cool thing.
And Zenoscope, the people behind Grim Fairy Tales, have the Grim Tales of Terror, which seems to be sort of a... I don't know, not Twilight Zone-ish, more like Tales from the Crypt DC Comics style thing. There is, of course, Marvel's presenting Doctor Strange the Oath, the first full issue of Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin's Doctor Strange story, which, to my mind, is still the best Doctor Strange story ever told.
That was probably about 10 years ago or roughly that it came out.
We saw that trade regularly.
And as one of the great Doctor Strange stories, I expect that... as the movie closes in, it is going to be the best-selling Doctor Strange comic on the shelves.
Yep.
And here's your chance to get a little sample of it without having to pick it up yet.
We will be seeing an ongoing Doctor Strange book starting next month.
Yep. And then finally, I picked up the Fragments of Horror by Junji Ito, which is a little sampler, a couple little short stories from...
the manga master of horror.
That's correct. Junji Ito, who we all love.
Right, we've talked him up before for Uzumaki.
And Gyo, his crazy haunted fish story.
Yes, and this is... But he's also put out several compilations of short stories, little vignettes ranging from like 4 to 8 or 16 pages, and it looks like that's got several of them in there.
Yep.
These are always creepy little stories, you know. His art is just creepy, too. Even his normal people look kind of sickly and emaciated, which is, as we noted, with his cute cat comic coming out, it's going to be a little weird.
Yep. Dave, did you see that Junji Ito is actually was one of the guys on the canceled video game?
The Silent Hill game.
Yes,
So, just
to turn the knife a little further.
Right. There was people involved were Guillermo del Toro, Hideo Kojima of the Metal Gear series, which has a hugely successful new outing right now. Junji Ito, we now learned.
Yep.
And there was somebody else big in it. I was like, there's like four mega people.
Here's my theory.
Is it just too many cooks?
What if... Don't...
too many.
Nope. No. What if it was going to be so good that it was going to open some kind of dimensional warp and bring Cthulhu to Earth and Konami saved us all by canceling it?
What if those four guys were trying to use it to warn us?
Yes.
They were not going to summon it, but they were trying to warn us. But the forces of darkness have triumphed over them temporarily.
Yeah. Now, see, you're putting a negative spin like it's a bad thing. I'm saying Konami has saved us all by canceling this game. So the good news is, the bad news is you're not going to get to play the most awesome horror game ever. The good news is your soul is not going to be eaten by an elder god.
I think it's more likely that Konami saw the budget total and was
I
thought it was, it had to be crazy.
No, we're done.
You know what's funny, though, is that I don't usually play horror games, but I would have bought the hell out of that game.
Yeah, it's just like too many people to not try it.
Yeah.
They had that weird little sort of sampler slash... What was it? There was a thing that people didn't even know.
There was like
a
free demo you could download, and then
it was like a walkthrough of a house, and it was like really creepy.
And it's gone now. Like if you download it and you have it, you can keep it.
I missed it at the time.
You can't get it anymore.
I did not know that all these guys were involved.
Yeah. So. All right. Quick bits of news this week. This is actually probably. I always say this, and it never turns out to be true, but I think this is going to be one of our shorter podcasts.
Right.
We started a little late.
Topics and stuff like that.
It's a lighter week of comics. There's not as many topics, not many news. So it's probably going to be a lighter podcast, by which I mean it'll probably be an hour.
Right.
All right. So first of all, news out of the Diamond Comic Summit in Baltimore.
Right.
Which is where Diamond talked about 250 different retailers.
It's just like a retailer expo.
Yeah. One of the things that Marvel presented was the Master of Kung Fu Omnibus.
I saw this. This is the 70s era, yes. Master of Kung Fu.
Paul Gillespie, Doug Mensch.
Right. And I believe has generally been out of print because of copyright issues over his father, yes. The character's father, Fu Manchu.
Yeah, Shang-Chi's father, Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, is the lead. He is very much a Bruce Lee in, what's the movie where he's the spy guy?
Enter the Dragon.
He's very much Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon influenced. But he is this sort of kung fu guy who gets recruited by MI5 to work for them. His father is the fiendish Fu Manchu, who was public domain at the time.
You would have thought it would be public domain now, but there must be an estate or something.
Yeah, there's something. So they can't do it, but somehow they must have worked out some kind of deal so they can at least do a one-time reprinting maybe.
Yep.
These are going to be huge hardcover omnibuses. It's going to be four volumes because this is a big, long run. But if you want sort of great action espionage comics...
Yep.
Probably, and this stuff is so good.
70s kind of flair to it. You know, yeah.
All the girls are in flared pants.
Yep.
All the guys wear jumpsuits. There's a lot of bare chests.
Right.
There's a lot of manly hair.
And some disco babes.
There's some implied off-panel sex.
Yep.
There are dudes with blades for hands.
You know, it was...
Razor Fist.
Razor Fist.
You know, Doug Lynch is one of those guys who kind of was bringing a certain level of, I want to say sort of a cinematic style of sophistication to comics.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have not read these comics, but I've read later efforts because these guys have worked together forever.
Yeah.
Doug Lynch is the writer, and Paul Gillespie is a very talented and also cinematic artist.
Yep.
And this is like the series where they cut their teeth on.
Yep.
And also, I would say probably one of those series that that brought cinematic fight scenes to comics.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just sort of what I always think of as the traditional American superhero style of the highlight reel of fights, you know,
right.
The big punches, they would show like, you know, block, parry, counterpunch, you know, you would get these really amazing action sequences.
Yeah. So, and Shang-Chi is very much one of these reluctant warrior types, you know, your Riggs, the guy who's so good at killing but who doesn't want to kill anymore,
right.
Your enemy ace.
Trying to get out of the game.
Yeah, and it's really, really good. I've read, if not all of it, a good chunk of it. And
we
I had to read it digitally.
Okay. I thought you were getting the black and white ones.
No, they didn't do that. This has not been in print for like 30 years.
Yeah.
At least, maybe 40. It's like, I don't think it's ever been collected in trades in any kind of format. So I had to go digital to read this. Uh-huh. And I finally did and really, really liked it. So I am anxiously awaiting the chance to pick this up in a hardcover format. I'm very excited. I didn't think this was ever going to happen.
Plus, it'll be, like, so heavy you can use it to fight off ninjas.
Yes, and I will. Also, there's been a big change over at DC for one of DC's oldest heroes, the Spectre.
Yeah, this was a bit of news that came out of the... Well, I guess it's a sleeper comic in a way.
This is a spoiler for Gotham by Midnight number 9. But for those who don't know the Spectre, Corrigan has always been sort of... He's a police detective from the 30s who got killed, was possessed by a spirit, sometimes depicted as an angel, who is the wrath of God, basically.
Right.
And he has sort of godlike powers. He can punish the wicked with all kinds of crazy... There was a drug dealer, like, he turned himself into fire and injected the drug dealer into his fiery veins and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, He almost did, even though he was the hero, these Freddy Krueger-esque vengeance kills. And he did kill people all the time, especially, I believe that approach, though, began in the 70s. Previous to that, he'd been in, like the old Golden Age version was in the Justice Society and stuff.
Right, yep.
And probably was not so kill-happy, I'm guessing.
Probably
not.
But he's always been sort of God's wrath.
Yep.
And they revealed in Gotham by Midnight number 9 that in New 52... That basically Jim Corrigan is the one who's been driving. The Spectre gives him the power, but that it was always what Jim Corrigan is the one who wants to do what he does.
Right. So does that maybe imply, I don't know if this is supposed to be the case, but you know, I think there's been times when he's heard these otherworldly voices and you're just like, oh my God, God is talking to him. And it's like the idea that maybe he's a little just bent out of shape in the head and he was just hearing voices.
What's interesting is I'm seeing a lot of people who are writing about this. This is written about an IO9, which is where we saw the story. And a lot of people have been talking about it online. Everybody seems very on board with this. They really like this twist. I hate it.
Really?
Yeah, I hate it.
I saw both reactions. Our friend Max Romero.
Yeah.
He posted about it and I saw their responses. And I saw several people who hated it. Max and I think, both ended up on the side of... The Spectre has always... His kills have been more what you would expect of a villain.
Sure.
So, depending on where they go with it, you know, I don't know if this is a permanent status quo or a storyline. But as a storyline, I like the idea.
I believe it is something the guy at Gotham by Midnight created, and Gotham by Midnight is canceled in 3 issues, and that will never be touched upon again. And it's one of these internet things is making a big deal of. I actually don't think this is going to be a permanent status quo change.
I'm gonna take that bet. I believe it will show up in their other Mystic stuff as percolating.
So I'll both lose a bet and be unhappy about the results.
Nick, any response?
I mean.
I believe what they're saying is, like, the Spectre will kind of be going villainous, right? As a result of this.
Well, that was the interpretation. That's just one article writer's interpretation.
And the story, I don't think, is completely done.
No.
He's always been sort of anti-hero-ish in a lot of ways.
Sure.
Same way, like, Punisher is and all. I think characters like that.
Yeah, so, in the 90s John Ostrander series, he would question very often what he was doing, especially, like, when he killed everybody in an entire country once.
Yeah. No, I like the moral ambiguity, but I don't like this notion of... It cheapens him if he's just a dude with powers.
Well, so here's the thing. First of all, it is the New 52 version.
Yeah.
And you know, I enjoyed my 90s version, but this is literally a different spin on the character, so I can accept that. But I've always felt, even when I was liking John Ostrander's series, he's too powerful a hero. He was like literally like on par with Superman, but magical sort of.
Yeah.
And I feel like super powerful characters like that work best as villains, and that's why I think it might be an interesting take.
When I was reading Ostrander's series, I always felt like he was on the outside. It was basically a Vertigo series. He was on the outside of the DC universe.
Sure.
So I didn't care how he fits into the DC cosmology.
I don't like that it's a crazy... That basically it's just a crazy person.
Yeah.
I think you need the entity.
If that is what it is, is that what it's supposed to be? Is he...
The entity says it's you, it was always you. Okay. There is a Spectre entity, but he clearly says that basically Jim Corrigan is the one making the decisions about what happens.
Yeah. People noted that this was not dissimilar to the concept that Alan Moore did when he reinvented Swamp Thing in, like, 1981 or whatever it was.
Again, though, that's just that one writer saying that, or is this something that's going around?
What's that?
That was something that the writer of IO9
said. I thought that was a reasonable point. The idea was originally that way back when Swamp Thing was created in the 70s, that there was an explosion, Alec Holland had gotten blasted into a swamp, and the swamp muck had, like, merged with him and he became Swamp Thing, and he was looking for a cure, just like the Hulk. But Alan Moore said, no... You were actually died in that, but the worms that literally ate his body in the swamp sort of like processed his intelligence. It was like planaria worms or whatever.
Yep.
And I don't know if they were supposed to be magic or what, but essentially they sort of merged with all the gunk down there. And it was really just an echo of his consciousness that formed it, and he was going to forever be Swamp Thing.
Sure, but
that was a big reveal.
Sure, but two things. One, that's Alan Moore.
Yep.
And this isn't Alan Moore. And two, that was in sort of the off to the side, not really DC, semi-Vertigo thing.
Sure.
This is dead smack in the middle of DC.
Gotham by Midnight is not dead in the middle of DC.
I don't know. I don't like this development, but it's, to me, it's, I mean, but I also to some extent don't care. Mm-hmm. It's yet another thing I don't like about New 52, so who cares? I mean, it's just another thing that shows that DC right now is not for me.
I'm adopting certainly the wait and see. I could see it implemented poorly, but I could also see it done well with it.
Yeah, we will see. I'm going to be the anti-change fanboy here and say I don't like it. Finally got a bit of a video teaser for Jessica Jones, the new Netflix show. Yeah. It is not much of a teaser. It is like 40 seconds long.
I decidedly liked it more than the first one, though, that was essentially just sort of graphics.
Basically an announcement, yeah.
You know, it was like a title sequence sort of or something like
that. Yeah, we'll embed this in the links, but basically it's an alarm clock set to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's going off, and a woman reaches over and crushes the alarm clock to pieces.
There's also, for flavor, the camera pans through the apartment before that. And you see, like, overturned booze bottles, like kind of a junky apartment.
Yeah.
Clearly not a person who is... maybe at their best in life at the moment, which is for sure what the comic depicts.
Yeah, it's definitely got the vibe you want.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
I thought it was a good tease of the flavor of the character.
I agree. I'm waiting to see more, but I like this teaser.
Mm-hmm. It's Netflix. It's Marvel. They've got my attention.
Yeah.
Oh sure. Yeah. Even before even with the previous trailer, which I was like, on. It didn't dissuade me one bit from wanting to see it.
No, because we all like Daredevil.
Yeah.
And I like all the cast members. And
yep.
I think it would be great. Do we know, is Luke Cage going to be on the show?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're not doing Carol because Carol, of course, is kind of off. Is probably going to be getting her own movie.
Reserved for a movie.
They're doing Patsy Walker.
Yep. Is she going to be her best friend?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, which I like.
And they're also there's another friend in there as well.
Who's that?
We don't know who it is. It's Carrie Ann Moss.
Oh, right.
We don't know who she is, but
yeah. Huh. I don't know. At any rate.
It could be an invented character, I suppose.
True.
Or it could be Carol, for all we know. I don't know. I just assume they were saving her for Captain Marvel. But anyway, looks good. All right, that's all the news we got this week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about comics for the week. All right, we're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 30th, and this is a five-week month. If people don't know, that usually means the stuff gets spread out a little bit. So there have been a lot of lighter weeks this week, this month. And this week in particular is a sort of a light week. If there are trades you've been wanting to try out or series you're curious about, this is a good week to pick up some extra stuff because it's a lighter week. That said, I liked everything I read this week.
Yep. Yeah, I think so far it's good.
I had a few that I was like, meh on, but like the first three books I read preparing for the podcast, I was like, winner, winner, winner. They were all stuff I really liked.
Yeah. So the picks we have this week are mostly not number ones. I've got one number one, which isn't really a number one.
Yeah, there simply aren't that many debuts this week.
So you may be hearing some familiar.
Yeah.
But Dave, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. So my pick is, once again, Zodiac Star Force. This is the Zodiac Star Force number 2 from Dark Horse Comics.
Yep.
It's essentially a slightly modernist take on what they would call the magical girl thing.
Sailor Moon.
Sailor Moon. But that is like its own whole giant thing in Japan.
Yeah,
like
sure.
The same way we've got a zillion superhero comics, they've got a zillion magical girl comics about sort of normal girls who, I guess, find themselves either through usually mystically empowered to fight evil or something. And the second issue continues all the stuff that I liked about the first ones, which is to say it's a mixture of high school friend drama between these five girls, one of whom is like seems to have been like kind of injured, almost like she's like sick from like this mystical darkness from something that happened in the first one.
Right.
But is also kind of shutting her friends out. Anyway, so it's a mixture of their kind of personal drama and, yes, fighting monsters. Like,
yep.
These like sort of demonic think forces materialize in the school. There may be somebody else in the school who's like sort of a vessel for them. There's some other stuff that unwinds in this one. Some other interesting sort of not the politics between friends, but yeah, I guess that's sort of what it is.
Okay,
is a big part of the book. One of the girls crushing on another girl that's in the group, and that's kind of a thing. You described it, Randy, I think, as the Lumberjanes meets Sailor Moon, and that sounds like probably still a fairly fitting description.
Yeah.
There's not exactly a lot new that happens in this, but it did confirm that I think this writer's got chops. I don't know who it is. Let's see. His name is Kevin Panetta, and I like the art of Paulina Genicho, I'm going to say. That looks like it's what it is. There's a quote from Kate Leth, the sort of rising star writer. Zodiac Star Force is everything I want in a modern magical girl story. Friendship, diversity, sweet battles, and enviable costumes. But I would say of this, this is not like literally picking up a Sailor Moon comic, you know, I have never read Sailor Moon before. And I would, again, encourage people who kind of like the idea of taking something that's common like that and then going a little bit deeper with characterization, almost not quite in the same way Kurt Busiek does superheroes with Astro City, but a little something like that.
Okay.
To give it a shot. So that's my pick.
Nick, what's your pick this week?
I think my pick is something that we all would have picked.
Yes, this was on my list, definitely.
Yeah, this is Archie number 3, which is Mark Waid, Fiona Staples, continuing the antics of Riverdale.
And in the case of Fiona Staples, concluding.
Oh, is this her final
issue? This is her final issue.
Oh, okay.
Number 4, they have a new artist taking over, Annie Wu, I believe.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, she's great.
No, but this actually introduces a newcomer to Riverdale, and that is Veronica, right?
Veronica Lodge.
Briefly glimpsed up in the previous issue where Archie accidentally kind of destroyed her house.
Yep.
Which,
because he's clumsy.
Yeah, he's clumsy. And but this actually is full issue about her and sort of how she is inserting herself into life in Riverdale via, you know, the school, the relationships.
And she's basically like, almost like a Paris Hilton type,
yeah.
Or Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, she had a reality show.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, so a lot of things, Mark Waid kind of, he writes sort of what you expect, but he does do a spin on it as well. I mean,
for just a little bit, I almost thought he might be going too far with it. Like,
did you?
A little too cliche. Although the writing was also, it was so funny. Like, and I was actually showing, you know, the you guys scenes in this. I was like, look how funny this is. It's awesome.
They hit a point where they humanize her, too, which I thought was really
important. And that's the key thing is, like, I was like, okay, you know, Veronica has always been the spoiled rich girl.
Yeah.
But if they didn't find something to kind of make me like her as a character, I was worried, and they
do. The other thing I think I like a lot about this is that the first two issues were about giving us the new Archie, the new Jughead, and the new Betty, and what they're like in this new world.
Yep.
And this is the same thing for Veronica. It is true to the character, but a completely new take.
Yep, it updates all. It updates everything and for a modern era. And
it is, as Dave said, hilariously funny.
It is. But it's got an edge to it as well,
it does.
Really think.
It does.
And honestly, it's my favorite take on Jughead. He is the character that I like the most.
Yep.
So in this, she has Archie on a leash, more or less, a metaphorical leash throughout it. Partially because she did not tell her dad that he accidentally trashed a bunch of their house while he was like working on their lawn and accidentally broke up a bunch of stuff. Right.
And partially because he's just attracted to her.
He's infatuated with her. And Jughead is the best friend who's kind of trying to wrestle a way out of this and figure out what's going on.
He's just looking, trying to keep, you know, Archie in his best interests.
He also wants Archie and Betty to stay together.
Right.
Which Betty doesn't want either.
Right.
I also really like, one of the things I really like here is that I've read a fair amount of Archie, and I don't believe there's really that much, like, Jughead and Veronica don't really interact much. Like, she doesn't think of him, he doesn't think of her. Like, this was interesting that the two of them have a relationship based on her relationship with Archie and his relationship with Archie.
Right.
And I think that's the level of sophistication that's at work here. There's also some great stuff with Veronica and some of the other rich girls who are new characters.
Yep.
That's really fun. And Fiona Staples' art is great in this.
Yeah, I'm going to hate to lose her. I'm glad she essentially got to do each sort of the big three characters.
Yeah.
Archie, Betty, and Veronica.
Yep.
Not Jughead, but he is so prominent in all of the stories that she effectively got Jughead.
Yeah, I guess.
We got a sort of origin story for Jughead.
Jughead was pretty heavily in that first issue.
Yeah. Incidentally, also complimenting her storytelling, there's some nonverbal panels, some silent panels with Jughead in this, you know, communicating like just with hand signals and stuff to Betty.
Yeah.
And it's just hysterical. Fiona Staples is so good at it.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I loved it. Like, I'm sure I'm going to continue to love it, because I'm just liking what Mark Waid's doing here.
Yeah, agreed.
And I feel like it is John Hughesian.
Yeah.
Not quite. Yeah. It's like, they're not talking about teen sex all the time.
No.
But it has that kind of, the wit of a Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or 16 Candles, or one of those movies. And so I feel like a lot of people who should be trying it out. It's already doing great.
Yeah, it is.
But more people should be reading it.
I mean, sort of a sly, modern slice-of-life comic?
Yeah.
All right. My pick is another one that we've talked about a lot. That is Grayson Annual number 2. I don't know if I'm on record about this, but I hate annuals in general. I think it's an antiquated notion. It's usually just a filler issue by a different creative team that doesn't have any impact on the actual main story.
Right.
This one is a it's by the main writers, Tim Seeley and
Tom King.
The artist they've got is Alvaro Martinez, who is solid, if not as amazing as Mikkel Jenin, certainly really good.
It seemed like it was still somewhat in Mikkel Jenin's wheelhouse of style.
Yeah, it's really good. And basically, this is a story where the new Superman, with no powers and looking younger than Grayson.
Well, not no powers, but lower
powers. Lower powers. Meets Grayson, now a super spy. And They do a flashback to when they first met and interacted as Superman and Robin, and then they jump ahead to Grayson picking right up from the last issue where he's leaving Gotham and to go back to work for Spiral, where he and Superman sort of meet and team up against the bad guy that they have a past relationship with. It's got great action, a great chase sequence, and just a lot of fun interactions between a couple of guys who've been through a lot together. There's an early panel or an early sequence where Grayson spends I think it's like two paragraphs of text describing his crazy life since he's been like, you know, outed, supposedly murdered, undercover, all this crazy stuff that's going on. And then Superman's, he's like, okay, here's my story of all the crazy stuff. Like, I had superpower, big, huge superpower, then no superpowers. They're slowly coming back. My secret identity's been outed.
Right.
I have a motorcycle now. And it's just kind of, it's almost sort of parodying the crazy up and downs of the status quo of it all.
Yeah.
But it's in sort of a funny, loving way. And they do a great job with their villains, who are a team, something I wasn't super familiar with. Nick reminded me what they were. And
I just started reading it. Can we say what their name is?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Was it like Fist something?
Yeah, the Fist of Cain. Yeah.
Fist of Cain. I was not familiar with it, but I just started to read that annual before we began the podcast. I read about 5 or 6 pages. And when he's explaining to Superman what their deal is, it's an awesome. I really liked the idea behind him.
Yeah. But there's a lot of fun stuff with Superman operating lower power level, Grayson operating without all his usual bat gadgets, and just a couple of guys you don't usually see teaming up.
I also appreciated in there, just, you know, it's one of those differences between characters, Superman and, say, Batman. It looked like when Superman, when he ran into Grayson and found out he was still alive, he immediately gave him a hug.
Yeah.
He's like, Dick, you're back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's very Superman. I liked it.
All right, so in a weirdly, in a week that is so small, we all have cheater picks.
Yep.
So I really liked, I've been talking about these one-shots of S.H.I.E.L.D., the 50 years of S.H.I.E.L.D., and I've liked all of them. My favorite, of course, was Mockingbird, because I'm a big Mockingbird fan.
Right.
And I'm happy that writer is going to be doing a Mockingbird ongoing series,
which
I'm super excited about. They haven't announced the artist. I'd love it if it was Joel Jones again, but I don't think it will be. This is a one-shot featuring the Cavalry, a.k.a. Melinda May from the show. It's another one of those weird ones where she has only existed in the show, and they're kind of retconning her quietly into the Marvel Universe as if she's been around forever. The writer is someone I'm not familiar with named Jody Hauser.
Incidentally, I prefer that approach, I think, to the hoops that they jumped through to bring in Nick Fury Jr.
Yeah,
to replace Nick Fury.
I agree. This is the way I prefer them to do it. The artist is Luke Ross, who you may have seen on various cross-gen things, sort of a fun, realistic style. And basically, this is Melinda May, S.H.I.E.L.D. badass, who has a lot of... rumors about her as to why they call her the Cavalry. The people say, you know, she took out 30 agents on her own, that kind of thing. She is doing the final training for a team of 4 S.H.I.E.L.D. operatives, or would-be S.H.I.E.L.D. operatives, a tactics specialist, the tank, tech, and weapons. And these 4 S.H.I.E.L.D. operatives go to a sort of a war game space and are supposed to be using their paint guns to sort of... take on May, who is pretending to be their adversary for this one.
Mm-hmm.
And then an actual threat enters the field, and they have to see her in action, and they have to adapt and work with her. It is a really fun little... I like to... Introducing these 4 characters, they do a good job introducing them. I like them all. Sets up the story, delivers it all, and gets out. It's a great example of how you do a one-shot.
Are they going to... I assume they're going to collect all of those one-shots.
Yeah, so they are going to collect all the S.H.I.E.L.D. one-shots into one trade, along with a couple other S.H.I.E.L.D. stories, and... I am leaning towards picking it up. I thought all these one-shots would be very forgettable and throwaway.
Yeah.
And I actually thought they were all good. Maybe nothing hit quite great, but they're all really solid performers.
Right, right.
So,
like an annual that comes through.
Yeah, it's like an annual that comes through. It's a rarity.
Just like the other annual that came through this
week. Exactly. So, I recommend it. If you haven't picked up any of these S.H.I.E.L.D. one-shots, you don't have to read all of them. There's no thread that ties them all together. But all of them have been good, and this one's no exception. Nick, what is your cheater pick?
My cheater pick is M.O.D.O.K. number 5.
Yeah.
M.O.D.O.K. Assassin. That's true. And this is actually comes down to M.O.D.O.K. being in love.
Yep.
That's sort of the core of the story.
Who is it with?
Angela.
The Asgard's assassin, right?
She's
a Thor.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But definitely things come to a head in this one.
Because M.O.D.O.K., giant head.
Yeah. You know. I try. Dealing with not only Baron Mordo, a few other threats.
Baron Mordo, the big Doctor
Strange villain. But he's like the Baron of Killville. So it's sort of their final confrontation.
Is it the final issue of the series?
It is. The threads get sort of tied up. There's some great character work between Angela and M.O.D.O.K. His dialogue is just cracks me up. I think Christopher Yost did a great job with it.
I forgot he was the writer on it.
Yeah.
He has turned in some good stuff in the last few years.
Yeah, he has. I think more or less I've liked most of what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything from his like New X-Men or not New X-Men. What was he? It's like writing the Hellions and stuff.
On what he's been writing lately, but I just remember the like. There was a time when I thought I think he was kind of doing the some Grimdark comics and. I knew he created X-23 okay. for the animated X-Men stuff.
Correct me if I'm wrong, he did a lot of work in animation, right? Didn't he do, like,
Avengers? Yeah, Ghost was behind, the really good Avengers cartoon, yeah.
Yeah, and he also did
and some other stuff.
X-Men stuff, right?
Yeah. He did the Wolverine and the X-Men, both of which are great series that are on Netflix.
He just got MODOK in a way that I don't think anybody else has and put an interesting spin on him without compromising who MODOK is and sort of the lethality that he can
does that now without getting into any specifics. This series has balanced, you know, some humor and dark humor with like some more serious stuff. Does it end on a serious note, a humorous note? Would you say it's a?
It ends on a serious note, actually. Okay. Like a lot of the Secret Wars titles do.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I was kind of hoping it might. You know, it seemed like there was some drama to be had there.
There's some character growth as well, which I was very happy to see.
I'd like to see that among giant, oversized evil heads.
That's very true.
Try and beat that, Arnim Zola. Where's your comic, Arnim Zola?
Oh, doing nothing. Sad.
Or Hector Hammond.
Arnim Zola sits in the corner and cries.
Tears of evil.
Dave,
my pick is the I did it's weird for a series that was so delayed. Captain America White is coming out rather quickly. Is it biweekly?
Yeah, because it's done. They waited until it was all done. Yeah.
Well, that was probably at least the way to go for that, and maybe any subsequent projects these guys do.
Yeah.
Anyway, really liked the issue. It's a rather focused one. The previous issue, I think the Howling Commandos and Cap and Bucky were on a plane going on a secret mission, and they got shot down over the ocean.
Like you do.
And this issue follows what happens afterwards, and very much focuses on sort of the bond sort of that Cap and Bucky took for granted at the time, but, you know, didn't realize, you know, how much it meant until, you know, after Bucky was thought dead. And there is more. I think y'all did not like the sort of antagonism between the Howling Commandos and Cap. A lot of curiosity. Do we know for sure that was not part of, you know, kind of that like that sort of GI ribbing?
It's possible. I don't think it was, but I don't know.
I bet it might have been. But anyway,
I don't like it.
It continues. It continues in this one. So Randy, you just stay away from it.
I will.
But there's some really cool stuff. They sort of do some survivalist stuff. And it pits Cap's sort of optimism against Sergeant Fury's kind of pessimism in this. And there's a lot of fun, colorful stuff with the Howling Commandos in it, too. Like when they're in the water and they find land, and, you know, most of them are carrying, like, a weapon over their head trying to keep it dry. And, like, one of them, their bugler guy, is, like, keeping his bugle precious and safe above the water. So a lot of good character bits in there. Anyway, I am just continuing to enjoy it. I believe it's going to be another notch in the Loeb Sale Marvel series.
Cool. All right. On my list of other stuff I'm picking up this week, there are exactly one thing. Well, okay, one comic and one hardcover. Shield number 10, which brings in Evan Doc Shaner to do art on a Howard the Duck series. If you've been reading Howard the Duck, you should pick this issue up because it feels very much like a Howard the Duck story.
Yeah, it does.
This also brings back the owl-headed S.H.I.E.L.D. agent from the Mystic episode, who I really liked. Fitz sort of takes the lead. It was a lot of fun, and there's an especially great funny running joke about all the characters have come back from the dead at Marvel. And then there's the Southern Bastards hardcover from Image. Now, first caveat, I thought this was going to be super oversized like all their other hardcovers. It's not. It's just trade size.
It's a baby hardcover.
Which is kind of a bummer, but that said, it collects the first two story arcs, the first eight issues of Southern Bastards, which is a Southern Fried Crime series that I really dig. The art is by Jason Latour, who you might know as the co-creator of Spider-Gwen.
Right.
But he's the writer on that one.
Yes.
I always forget that
and
guy's
the
an artist.
And the writer, you might know, Jason Aaron, as the guy who's done Thor.
Yep.
And Thor's.
And what's this? Is he doing Star Wars?
And Star Wars.
Yep. That guy has...
he wears lots of hats.
Worn lots of hats, yeah. And he started out as sort of a Vertigo type guy. Yeah. It's interesting to see.
Other Side was
not that
book.
This is not a rather...
This is a very Vertigo-y book, yeah.
But But it's interesting to see how he has been able to rather successfully transition to a sort of mainline Marvel stuff. Star Wars, you don't get more mainstream.
You know, Brubaker was a weird kid. Like, Brubaker did all this crime stuff and came to Marvel, and Daredevil was great because it was more in that crime vein.
Yeah.
But they did sort of a forgettable run on X-Men and other superhero stuff where it didn't feel right.
He killed Banshee,
and he created Kid Vulcan.
So some people don't transition well, but Aaron has done a good job of transitioning. He's also did a really fun run on Wolverine and the X-Men. The Southern Bastards is basically a Walking Tall sequel in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And the hardcover has about 30 pages of extra material at the end. It's got all the covers, including all the variants. It has a variety of sketchbook work, including some character designs from people like Tony Moore, Chris Samnee, Babs Tarr.
Wow.
So some little guest stars. And then it's got recipes. Southern recipes. A fried apple pie recipe by Betty Aaron, Jason's mom, which honestly, I may try. I'm like, this looks like something I could make.
Well, you know, I remember in the first issue, Aaron wrote like a little afterword talking about, you know, the book and its depiction of the South and growing up in the South and all of that. And so he very clearly had walked the walk.
Awesome. Jason Latour's mom provides recipes for banana pudding and fruit salad. And then there's some recipes for biscuits and mussels in Guinness beer. So if you need a good recipe book, I can promise you that.
Some violent Southern crime with it.
And then Southern Bastards Book 1 is the book for you. And I'm definitely picking this one up. Nick, what else is on your list?
I don't have a lot, but I do have the final issue of Ghost Racers.
Yep.
Which did end on a really good note. And then the fourth annual for Batman.
This is another one of those jumping on points, right?
Yeah, this is going to, I think, a few short stories. It might be just a full one by James Tynion. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I really liked the art. I'm curious to check it out.
All right.
Is that it for you, Nick?
That's it.
The only other thing I had to mention are some stuff I'm not necessarily following, but just thought was worthy of note. One is the second Wonder Woman 77 special.
They should go ahead and make this an ongoing series.
It was a huge hit before, and this is, if it's not obvious from the title, that this is like a sort of a really oversized comic that tells tales that are basically the Linda Carter Wonder Woman of the 70s. For many people, still the iconic Wonder Woman. And given that Wonder Woman has been sort of fumbled so much lately...
Yeah.
This Wonder Woman, I think, is still probably more what people want than a lot of the other stuff.
Yep, agreed.
They've got a bunch of good artists I saw flipping through it, so it seems to deliver. So, they should just go ahead and make it an ongoing series.
Yep.
And then eventually just make it the regular Wonder Woman comic.
Yep.
I will say, the art in it is awesome. I'm flipping through it right now, and I'm just like, these are great depictions of Cheetah and, you know, Wonder Woman in her classic getup and just the likenesses to Linda Carter and all the other things. They're great. And it's Mark Andrako writing, so I always have an interest when he steps into the writer's box.
The last thing I have is a new Image book. It's a fantasy series of sorts called From Under Mountains.
Yeah.
And I haven't read it yet, but this has the writer I didn't know, but I thought...
There's two writers.
Is the artist the person from Eight House?
Yes, the artist the person who did the first two Eight House issues. She is Brandon Graham's girlfriend, wife.
Okay.
She's done her own graphic novels. She's very talented. Marion Churchland.
Her art is really good. And I think the people who liked Eight House, which you might know as Arclight, although that was actually just the story title... If anybody who followed that, because we talked a little bit about it when the first issue hit, and you like the art, check out From Under Mountains, hopefully it'll be a good one.
All right, that'll cover our comics for the week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about, TV, movies, maybe more comics, who knows? All right, fall TV has started.
It has.
I have found it vastly disappointing.
And I've been entertained by it.
Yes.
You're just curmudgeonly.
No, I'm just, I am...
No, Randy, you're curmudgeonly.
Oh, that's true. But that's not what this is. I'm a TV snob.
Yeah,
unapologetically, you are. There is so much TV. We're at peak TV. I don't have time for stuff that's just okay.
Right. And I've really found that I kind of like procedurals.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's a lot of them. I do end up liking a lot of it.
Yep, and there's a lot of that kind of stuff on network TV. So, quick, Nick, what are the things you would recommend to people? Well, first of all, what would you notably not recommend? Because I believe I know what that one is.
Don't watch Heroes. Dear God, don't watch Heroes. I'm going to subject myself to one more episode just mainly because of one character. It's Zachary Levi. Why are you on the show?
I can't believe you're watching Heroes for a second episode.
I already watched the two-hour premiere. I have to subject myself.
When it hit Netflix streaming, I tried to watch the second episode of Gotham, which I believe you watched on when it came out, right?
I did.
So, bite your tongue, sir.
I might have made it through four episodes of Gotham, and then I was like, no,
I couldn't do it. And, you know, like, here's the thing. I enjoy some schlock TV. It just has to hit my particular buttons, and Gotham just wasn't doing it.
I still had a lot of, like, oh, I really liked Noah Bennett. I think he was an interesting character.
Sure.
But
who's that?
The Horn-rimmed glasses guy.
Yeah.
And they do some cool stuff with, you know, some okay stuff with him. But it's just the way the show is, you know, spliced and cut. They introduce characters just like in a scene, and then they cut to another character, and you never see those people for 2 hours, and you're like, okay, you've introduced 20 people, but I don't care about a single one of them.
And
really, it's bad.
The reviews have been that is basically eye-bleedingly bad.
Yeah. It's very close to eye-bleedingly bad. My eyes did not bleed, but it was close.
All right. Anything else you definitely don't recommend?
Rosewood was bad.
Was it?
I think I like Morris Chestnut.
Yeah.
And he's a good lead. The premise for the show feels like a carbon copy of Bones.
And Castle. Yeah, it is.
And not that those are bad shows to clone. It just feels weird to have sort of a private
pathologist
that, you know, is not connected to anything. You pay to have his services and sort of his interaction with the police force.
That's kind of interesting.
That's real. That's a thing.
I know. It felt kind of weird. And I don't know. I just wasn't sold by it. I don't think it's bad or anything. I wasn't wowed by it.
It looked like to me another one of these sort of Castle Bones type thing, but you're saying it is not up to that level.
No, I think Bones and Castle have a little bit more going for it. The middle of the road that I actually show that I want to talk about, I know Randy's seen, is the Muppets.
Yeah.
Because it's kind
of controversial.
Yeah, man, Muppets was love it or hate it, and I neither loved nor hated it.
I saw several people that I thought were, like, somewhere in the middle.
I thought that I was more... If it's a binary system, I loved it.
Yeah.
Because there were many, many jokes that hit for me.
Yeah.
I did find myself laughing quite a bit.
I never laughed, not once.
Well, that's sad.
I know. And because the thing is, I like all the people that are in it. They've got Wynn Duffy from Justified playing the dad of the woman who's played by the waitress, Always Sunny.
Yes.
Who's dating Fozzie.
Yeah.
And that just sounds like fun. And none of it made me laugh. And
a lot of the scenes I've heard described were pretty funny to me. These sort of adult humor that was somewhat controversial.
Well, it is very much sort of 30 Rock meets the Muppets.
Yeah,
I think as premises goes, that
does it
work.
30 Rock thing, I've heard that.
It's a show behind a show.
It's a show behind a show.
Oh,
and you kind of see the Muppets in a way we haven't seen the Muppets because they're a little bit more adult.
Right.
In the sense that you get to see their private lives.
Right. And I know that there is some, in that sort of Shrek-like way, there's some humor that's...
Yeah.
That is like sexual innuendo and stuff like that would probably go over the head of the kids. Some people were like, that should not even be in the Muppets.
Yeah, and I think I see that point of view, though. I do see people saying, it's cheap humor, it's easy jokes, and the Muppets shouldn't have to stoop to it. And I agree with that. But it's also, if it's funny and you're aiming at a different audience, then that's the way it is.
Neither here nor there. I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to the second episode tonight.
I'm going to give it a couple more episodes to win me over because I really want to like it.
I like all the guest guest people. Elizabeth Banks
was great.
And Imagine Dragons was on there as a musical guest.
Yep, sure.
And I there were too many jokes that hit for me that I'm like, okay, I'll keep watching.
Too many jokes.
the show that I had pretty much written off to start with, but I watched on a whim, that I loved was The Player.
I can't believe you love this show. I haven't seen it yet, but it looks so dumb.
And that might be because, I mean, it's so dumb that
it laps itself
a little bit.
Awesome.
Because there's some melodrama
crazy
in there that probably doesn't need to be, but the notion of an organization that can predict crime and they use that information so people can bet on whether a person can solve this crime or stop...
A
specific person can stop that
Played crime. By one of the leads from Strike Back.
Which I have not seen, but I've heard good
things. I really like Strike Back. And the other lead from Strike Back is on Blind Spot, which we'll get to.
Yeah, and then the main character that everyone will know is Wesley Snipes.
He
plays the pit boss, sort of the lead, the guy you don't mess with. And he's just fun. He delivers corny dialogue like no other person on that show.
And I know some of you might be thinking, what is Wesley Snipes doing this show on TV? You gotta remember that Wesley Snipes has trouble with the IRS.
I know, he needs money. But honestly, it's the way the show's cut. It's very fun. The action is very slick. There's some good character bits. I think there's an overarching mystery to the story because... You have to have it. You have to have something that moves sort of the story beats. It can't just all be about
gambling
rich
on
people
crime.
Gambling on whether or not crime gets solved, which is bizarre.
It's so weird that I'm trying to picture how this came up, you know, somebody pitching that, and I can't figure it.
Well, if you think that's a weird pitch, let's talk about Blind Spot. Because the pitch for Blind Spot is, it opens in Times Square, a cop finds a bag that has a bunch of different languages. It's a load of languages. On the other side, it says, call the FBI. Thinks it might be a bomb. They evacuate Times Square. And when they send the bomb squad, it unzips, and out comes a naked woman covered in tattoos, played by Jamie Alexander.
Oh, right. I was trying to remember what this was. This is the memento tattoo trying to be interpreted.
And this woman has a tattoo on her back that has the name of an FBI agent, played by the other guy from Strike Back, who they call in, and... they start interpreting, like, checking all her tattoos, which seem to have been made about a couple of weeks ago, basically.
Right. They're very...
am I correct? Did you say... does she have amnesia?
She has amnesia. There's some kind of drug that's administered to people that gives them, like, temporary amnesia.
Yeah, but she, like, overdosed.
She has so much of it that she doesn't remember anything.
She has muscle memory. She knows, like, how to, like, eat and all the other stuff.
Not just muscle memory, though. She also remembers whatever's convenient to the plot, like the bizarre Chinese dialect that's on her tattoos. She is clearly some kind of ex-special ops, so they can't find any records of her. So she kicks ass randomly.
Yep.
She is a walking plot device.
She is.
But if she was supposed to be some special agent, wouldn't it be possible that you might know weird dialects and stuff like that?
It's always very specific to the... it's like there are three people in the world who speak this dialect, and she happens to be one of them.
Right.
Yeah, it's a little... on the nose.
Yeah. I was going along with it till about halfway through, and then I decided I hated it.
I like the male lead, but they don't give him much to do.
No, they don't.
And that's a problem. They need to give him a little bit more. I mean, I like Jamie Alexander, too. And I think when we were talking about it, we compared it a little to Blacklist.
But, it's very much in that Blacklist vein.
But Blacklist has James
Spader. Blacklist
has
James Spader, and this doesn't.
And this doesn't.
I also think... I really do feel like this was one of those things where someone came into the office, was like, well, that's your pitch. Jamie Alexander's going to be naked in a lot of it. Sold. You don't want to hear the rest? No? I'm like, oh, good, because I don't have anything else.
Nick, what was your... did you like it?
I liked it well enough. I certainly did not hate it as much as Randy. I have the second episode recorded.
I was going to say, you're going to keep watching?
I'm going to keep watching.
Okay.
Most of these new pilots, I'm at least going to give 2 or 3 episodes.
Yep.
Unless... they really, really entertain me, and I'll outright just record all the entire series.
Has anything made that cut yet?
Player with episode 1.
Really?
Muppets has made it, just because I have a feeling.
Okay. And then we both watched Minority Report.
Minority Report.
And we're both really let down by it.
We were both let down for about the same reasons, I think.
Yeah.
I think budget.
Budget, it looks cheap.
It does.
They try to put everything from the movie in, which feels overstuffed. And their lead detective, Megan Good, the lead actress, is just boring.
Yeah, I wanted to like her so much, but again, talk about kind of cliche with every sort of thing that could fit into that character's background.
Yeah.
Are y'all going to watch second episode?
But I'm going to give it at least a couple more episodes because I really like the concept.
I like the concept, and I love the actors they got for the precogs. I think
they're solid. Yeah,
and I love their characters. They all have sort of diverse reasons for doing what they're doing right now, and I think that's interesting. If only that interest could be put into the cop character.
Nick, did you also watch Limitless on CBS?
I did, and that one surprised me. Mainly, I don't know the actor's name.
Yeah.
He sells it. He's very good. I thought very charismatic. Ron Rifkin plays his dad, which I love. Okay, Ron Rifkin.
Sure.
I'm used to seeing him as the villain in Alias.
Yep.
And seeing him as sort of this very down-to-earth dad who cares for his son, who is basically a guy who can do nothing right, just kind of a schlub.
Yeah.
Who very much like the movie Limitless, kind of lucks into the NZT, which is the drug that gives you your brain the ability to expand and know everything.
Like fire on all cylinders.
I heard that some of the abilities they give it, NZT gives him in the show, is maybe even a little bit beyond what happens in the TV show, in the movie. Like maybe they expand a little too far.
Maybe a little bit.
Like he can suddenly parkour?
Not really parkour, he just knows, like, the best route.
Okay, so that makes sense.
I didn't feel like anything was above and beyond what they did in the movie.
Yeah, that's a little bit like what they did in, like, Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes.
I think the scene that you're referring to is where he's jumping down off of a roof, and he knows the exact weight his body can take before his bones sort of, like, contract or something.
Okay.
No, and he's able to grab hold and sort of fall from fire escape to fire escape.
Right.
Okay.
It wasn't really parkour.
You knew if you weren't going to hurt yourself, you could do some kind of daring, crazy stuff that you would otherwise be falling all over.
That doesn't sound super far from the movie.
And
so.
The female lead in this is somebody that both of you will know. I don't remember her name, but she played Dexter's sister.
Jennifer Carpenter.
Jennifer Carpenter. She feels kind of watered down when you see her.
Well, that's because she can't curse.
She can't curse.
Right.
And I know I've seen a lot of people complain about that. Because
Jennifer Carpenter is basically a poetess of cursing. That is her best skill.
Yeah. She, you know, they give her some interesting backstory. So I'm fine with her. And it was nice because Bradley Cooper does make an appearance in this. So,
which is pretty cool.
As his character from Limitless.
So is he a senator?
No. It's not a huge spoil. If spoilers, go watch the pilot. But he's actually like a drug kingpin at this point.
Okay, all right. That makes sense.
He has perfected NZT to the point where it has no ill effects.
Okay.
And he is makes a deal with the main character to sort of not blackmail him a little bit, but definitely he becomes his emissary in some ways. He knows he needs help with a certain thing. He won't tell him what this is.
Okay.
So it's basically this new character is working two things. He's working for Bradley Whitford, but he's
Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Whitford, different person. Bradley Cooper, and he's also working for the cops because the cops or the FBI,
right? Yeah,
knows what NZT is, and for some reason believes that this character, his body can, you know, not be terror or destroyed by it.
Right, right.
So they're going to utilize him and his abilities. So I'm in for it.
I hope that Bradley Cooper's character is actually like in a shadow war with Carl Van Loon. Isn't that his name? Van Hoon, whatever.
Yeah.
Robert De Niro's character. Because if that's the story, I'd be interested. I've heard sort of lukewarm stuff on this. I'm glad to hear you enthused about it because I love the movie.
Yeah.
I would like to like the show, but it's on CBS, so I'm going to have to buy it if I want to watch it.
Right.
So I got to hear some good things about it. So I'll be interested to hear how that goes. Finally, we have Scream Queens on Fox, which Ryan Murphy's new anthology horror. He's already got American Horror Story, which is very much sort of gothic, you know, dark, grim horror.
Yes.
This one is very much informed by sort of the slasher flicks and Heathers. Yeah. And it's going to be an anthology, so like this season will be one story.
Yeah.
Next season will be completely different characters, new story.
I was weirded out by the first hour.
I didn't think I was going to like this because Ryan Murphy's sort of weird extreme style. Like he did Glee, he did Nip Tuck, and he did, of course, American Horror Story. And okay. I've never been a huge fan of his. I don't hate him. Some people just hate him.
Yeah, no,
but
I think he's very good at what he does.
But his style is not my style, and I'm not
like does like American Horror Story share something in common with Glee?
Yeah, and extreme tendency to go to extremes. And to have characters who are sort of wacky and out there.
Sort of, I can see it. So high on the melodrama.
His characters are more archetypal, and melodrama is definitely a big thing he does.
Yeah.
But
and this one is sort of tackling the horror sort of Scream type thing.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big fan of slasher stuff either, so I didn't think this was going to be up my alley, but the pitch was interesting. The trailers were interesting.
And we all, like, ended up liking the comic hack slash.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm not a slasher fan either, even though I like horror movies.
Yeah.
But Hack Slash was just well written.
Yeah. Well, this has that knowing wink and nod that Scream had.
Yeah, it does.
I
mean, it's about a sorority.
Yes.
The main character
is a terrible, terrible woman who you're hoping to see murdered.
Pretty much, and she's not getting murdered.
She's the worst, and
she showed up in other. I mean, she was on American Horror Story in several seasons. Yeah.
I like her. She's playing a character. She's doing a very good job of playing a character you want to be murdered.
Yeah, and basically, it's her rise to power, and then her in power as new pledges come into the sorority.
Right, and the sort of the twist that develops very quickly. Jamie Lee Curtis is the new dean of students.
Oh, that's right.
She had been the assistant dean. Jamie Lee Curtis is what kept me watching that first hour.
Yep.
Because she's great, and at first you think she's going to be sort of the hero of the piece, and that she basically sets things, and she talks to this head of this sorority, tells them they've been, you know, being mean girls forever, and that she's not going to let it stand, and that she basically talks to the national chapter president, who's a girl who's was a member in the 90s, and somehow she had a traumatic event, which we'll get back to, which just sort of left her in the 90s. So she's this, like, 30-year-old woman who's dressed like a 90s Heather girl.
Yeah.
And basically, she's a lawyer, and she comes in, and she and the dean work out this deal where, in order for good PR, the Kappa, wasn't that what's Kappa something?
Yeah,
I don't know. The sorority's going to take all comers. Like, anyone who wants to pledge can pledge.
Uh-huh.
So they've got the, you know, the losers and geeks and all this stuff, and it's more diverse than it would have been, and all this kind of thing. So there's a deaf girl, and there's a girl who has, like, a neck brace and all this kind of stuff, and they have to take them all.
Right. I mean, I also want to talk about, we mentioned Jamie Lee Curtis, but there's some pretty interesting supporting cast members in here, too. I mean,
yeah.
Chloe Moritz, who played Hit Girl, she plays one of the...
She does?
Yeah, she's one of the...
I just figured she was strictly movies.
The main clique people.
I didn't even notice that was her.
Yeah, she was one of the...
Is she Chanel number five?
She's Chanel number five.
Now you say that, it makes sense. Okay, you know how Heathers, all the Heathers were named Heather?
Yeah, these are Chanel.
For those who don't know Heathers, it's a movie called Heathers.
Yes,
about mean girls in high school.
Yeah. So the main girl's named Chanel, and she refers to all her flunkies as Chanel number two, Chanel number four, Chanel number five. Yeah.
But, and then... I would never have been able to pick her out, but my wife was like, that's Ariana Grande.
Yeah. And Ariana Grande has sort of a cameo appearance.
I was going to say, this sounds like it's a, I don't want to say stunt cast, but there's But he's always, like, I've only seen, like, a little bit of American Horror Story. There is a certain, like, you know, certain people pop, although they're also well chosen for their roles.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, now where's the slashing part?
So here's what's going on. Basically, there's this. It opens with, and this is not a spoiler, it's the first scene in the show. A girl at this sort of big prom formal in 1995, which is 20 years ago.
Right.
1995 is 25. 20 years ago, people. It's messed up.
Yeah.
I graduated college in 96. So they find this girl in their bathroom. They're having their big sort of, you know, spring formal type thing.
Yep.
And one of their members has a baby. She didn't even know she was pregnant. And she's like, she's in a tub. She has a baby, and the three of the mean girls are like, you know, just get it out of here, you know, get done with this. And the girl dies,
right?
And the baby lives,
right?
And then they pick up in 2015,
right?
So 20 years later, and then they really sort of play off like it could be anyone. There are several characters. It could be this 20-year-old, you know, clearly 20-year-old baby, maybe they're seeking revenge on this sorority for what they've done, because there is a guy going around.
Why did the mother die?
Because none of the sorority didn't help her.
Okay, so they just
let her bleed out, basically.
Yeah.
So there is a guy going around in a Red Devil costume, killing members of the sorority. And you will come to find out that this is the mascot of the school. That is what the costume is from.
Yeah.
But basically, there's all kinds of other mayhem going on at the sorority.
I have to just quick ask. Was the baby shown to be definitively a girl?
No, it's not definitively shown.
No,
so the devil guy could be the baby.
Very much so.
I'm assuming the devil guy is the baby.
But it could be somebody
else.
But
it could be a girl inside the devil guy costume.
Right. But it also, I thought you were saying that one of the girls that are the sorority girls could also be.
Could be, but I don't think so.
But at this point,
but there's probably going to be lots of twists.
Because
and turns
here's the thing: the lead character, our sympathetic lead, is a girl who's introduced. Her single dad is driving her to college, and it's sort of implied. You know, they basically say that her mom died very young.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh well, maybe she's the baby, but I don't think the math quite works out.
No, not quite. But
so I don't think she is. But I think they were leading us down that path. But Jamie Lee Curtis's character, who I thought was going to be sort of the dean, who was like the Law and Order type, she has got her own stuff going on.
Yep.
And, there's some interesting...
It's sort of like American Horror Story where everybody's got a backstory.
Everybody's both tarnished and also somewhat sympathetic.
Yeah. Yeah, even the most horrible girl gets sympathetic at some points. Like, you see her before she became sort of the Mean
right.
Girl Prime.
Yes.
Now, I didn't understand. There's humor to this, right? There's dark,
yeah,
dark
it's,
humor.
There's darkly funny, yes. Okay. There's also a dude who's gay.
Yes.
And they do some pretty... I think Ryan Murphy is gay, which means he can get away with the kinds of things yeah. he does. Because this is so... It's almost... It's so stereotypical.
And I will caution people, it is pretty gruesome.
Oh, it's very gruesome.
I mean...
Yeah.
Pretty gory, bloody,
right.
And
the era of American Horror Story and Hannibal and stuff like that. Yeah. Not completely unusual, but it's good to know about.
Well, this was my favorite of the pilots I've seen.
Yeah, it was good.
It is by no means a favorite show or anything.
Yeah, but I'm for sure going to check this one out. I don't really do a lot of TV, but I'll probably make time for this one. And
yeah,
see
it was a fun. Yeah. I mean, like Nick says, the first hour, it's a little slow to get going.
But okay. The second hour actually, it picked up, went some interesting ways, and yeah, I really dug it.
All right, Dave, you had a movie that you watched recently, The Cube.
Oh, right. This one's just a random rental. The Cube is a weird movie. It's like a Canadian production, I think. Came out in, what, 95, 98,
yeah.
something like that? And it looks a little bit low-budget and stagey, but it's kind of compelling throughout. It's sort of like an independent horror or survival kind of movie.
I mean, it's really just one location shot for
right,
the entire...
Right, but you don't feel like it is.
No,
though.
No.
But, yes, essentially, this group of, like... six people or so wake up inside a giant cubicle room. It's kind of got designs and stuff on the wall that look a little bit high-tech. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of this vibe of, like, the game Portal, you know, where
yeah,
like, you're
sure.
in this weird underground complex of some sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And on every side, each of the six sides is a door, like a sort of a little handle that opens like a little sort of hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And leads into an identical room, and that means there's one on the top and on the bottom. And to get to the top, you kind of have to climb up some rungs and stuff, and it's a little bit difficult to get to.
Hard to get to.
And they don't know why they're there. They don't quite remember how they got there. You know, it's that sort of like, you know, you might have been hit with a tranquilizer dart and you just don't remember it. Who knows?
Right.
And they don't know each other, and they're trying to figure out, is there some rationale behind it?
It's actually how we all started working together.
what is the place, and can they get out of it? And so they go through one or two rooms. They're all wearing, like, identical clothes, sort of like a jumpsuit kind of thing. And, you know, there's a guy who's a cop. There's somebody who's a nurse. Let's see, I'm trying to think what else there was.
There's a construction worker, an Indian.
At some point, are you all jokes, Randy?
Sorry. I haven't seen the movie. It's all I can contribute.
At some point, they run into a guy who's like a sort of mentally handicapped guy. And what happens is some of these rooms are trapped, like death traps.
Okay.
And they see one or two people get killed early on. And they're like, it's not something where you can get past the traps. If the trap goes off and you're in there, you're pretty much going to die. But they find some symbols and stuff on the wall that may indicate a sort of path through it, and they it becomes this puzzle-like thing that's almost like a video game in some ways. But there is—I heard this began as a one-act play or something somewhere, and there's a theatrical vibe to it. The characters start talking about their lives and comparing notes, and one of them sort of takes the lead. The guy who's a cop kind of is a natural leader. But it seems like everybody's kind of got something that they're hiding, and the sort of the power balance between them shifts around a little bit as it goes along, and they kind of figure out who can help with what to get them out, and if there is an out. And that part was really interesting, like kind of crazy high on the melodrama scale.
Yeah.
So the acting at times almost feels amateurish, but it also is just sort of larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same way sometimes, like in David Mamet movies,
yeah.
the characters can sound like they're speaking dialogue. Same kind of thing here. But it's an interesting sort of survival suspense movie mixed with a little like character study, too, and that sort of same focus you get in like Alfred Hitchcock movies like Rope, you know, all set in one room. I'm trying to think what else, like Lifeboat. Hitchcock did it a few times, but I like at the end I really kind of enjoyed it, despite some like thinking, wow, that was some overtop acting at some times.
Was this a random rental or is it streaming somewhere?
Yeah, random rental from Netflix.
Okay,
it could be streaming, but if it is, I don't know.
Okay, all right.
I came across it at one point on a list of movies about like. I think they were like all set in one place.
Okay.
And Randy, if you end up watching among your horror movies, the movie, the indie horror movie Pontypool,
yeah,
that is generally set in a single location and is really weird. But like, I love Pontypool. So,
okay.
When they do these ones right, I end up really liking it. And The Cube is maybe not for everyone, but if people who like horror or sort of weird survival concepts, if the idea sounds neat to you, worth a try. Definitely worth a try.
Okay. And then I've been putting this off for a while as far as talking about, but I got, when I went to the San Antonio convention, Valiant Comics loaded me down with literally every volume one. I think I mentioned this before. And I have been dutifully reading through the entire Valiant universe.
A vast interconnected universe, not unlike sort of the superhero universe of Marvel and DC,
yeah,
but not really full-on superheroes, though.
Yeah, the guy gave me very much the hard sell. I mean, he gave me a whole bunch of graphic novels, but he also was telling me that, you know, I think a lot of our people are fans of DC and Marvel in general. Like, they like the shared universe stuff they're getting. Mm-hmm. But if you're burned out on DC and Marvel, and some people are, or for whatever reason you don't want to read that, but you still miss a shared superhero universe, and that is a niche of comics. That's definitely a niche. I'm not sure how many of our audience is that in that.
Well, you know, when DC did their New 52,
yeah,
I was kind of like, I often think of myself as a guy where I'm like, just give me a good story. That's all I ask. But I did find that the changes in continuity were surprisingly off-putting to me, and I did not feel as connected with the world anymore as I had for, like, the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And so I was like, you know, that value of this sort of shared world of adventure is actually surprisingly high.
Well, Valiant is a shared, you know, Valiant's a company that's relaunched. This is, I think, the third or fourth relaunch of the series. So you don't have to have known any of the previous stuff. You don't have to have a fondness for the characters. I do have a fondness for these characters, and I think to some extent almost it's a detriment because I'm expecting what I saw previously.
Right.
But what I would say is theirs is it's a little bit of a darker universe.
Yeah.
It's more science fiction-y than anything else.
Yeah.
Like, the powers are based in psionics and alien technology. There's a little bit of magic, but it's not super common.
Right.
There's some time travel elements to it. There's some interdimensional elements to it. But basically, they have a series of books. And the pitch the guy gave me, which I thought was pretty good, is that if you want a shared superhero universe, Their universe is pretty small. You can keep up with it for like $40 a month.
Right.
You buy one or two books a week, you can keep up with everything. And that's
which you cannot really conceivably do
which
with
you
Marvel
can't
or
do
DC.
With Marvel or DC anymore. But if you wanted to buy, if you want to keep up with the entirety of a shared universe, Valiant is a good way to go. They also do the thing where all their trades are $10 for the first volume.
Right.
Now, they're all four issues, but that's still, it's a pretty good deal.
Right.
So I got a big stack of trades, and I've gone through, what, like 15 of them. I've read like 15 trades in the past few weeks. And not everything hit with me, but everything was at least solid, and there were a few that I legitimately really liked.
Uh-huh. Does a lot of work with really great talent.
And,
that's what's been catching our eye with them over the last few years, because, you know, I think we eyed the relaunch skeptically.
Yep.
A lot of us were big fans of these characters in the 90s, mm-hmm. kind of some of Exo Manowar, Magnus Robot Fighter.
Yeah, although Magnus isn't in there.
He's not in this one.
Yeah, they don't have Magnus, Solar, or Turok, because those guys are off separately.
But they've got, like, Exo Ninjak,
Bloodshot, Ninjak.
Right.
Those are the big ones.
And so, you know, we liked some of those characters and things, but we're like, ah, it's another relaunch.
Yeah.
But they have a lot of big talent on there.
And also, like I say, if you've never read it, it doesn't matter that it's a relaunch, because there's no throwback to the old stuff.
Correct.
This is a very much introduces something off the bat. So, yeah, the writers amongst them include Matt Kent, Jeff Lemire, Fred Van Lente, Joshua Dysart, Greg Pak,
Dwayne
Straczynski.
Yep.
It is a good amount of people.
Who's that guy who drew that Bloodshot? Was it Polito?
No, Valiant is done by Paolo Rivera.
Paolo Rivera, yeah. I knew there was some one of those artists.
There's also some really good art. Doug Braithwaite, who you might remember from some of Marvel UK. Clayton Henry. There's a lot of good people in here. Clayton Crane, who does the sort of painty art from Carnage, people like.
Right.
So, Nick, you read a couple of these, right?
I read a couple. I read The Valiant, and I read Bloodshot.
So, The Valiant is the one that I think we were all sort of interested in. It is a team book.
It is. It sort of focuses on the Eternal Warrior and sort of his struggle throughout time to sort of face off against this Eternal Nightmare.
Very monstrous Eternal enemy, yeah.
How is it a team book?
Like, okay, so here's the deal. There's always been in Valiant a guy named the Geomancer, right, who is sort of Earth's protector, and they can use various magical powers from the ley lines of the Earth and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So whenever Geomancer dies, a new Geomancer rises. The Eternal Warrior is the Earth's fist and steel, who protects the Geomancer.
Okay.
And the Valiant is about...
like an Uber bodyguard.
Yeah. The Valiant is about basically this eternal enemy who keeps rising and has killed every Geomancer for the last, like, 1,000 years. Yeah. Right under the Eternal Warrior's nose. He just, like, beats him and kills the Geomancer.
Yeah.
So there's a new Geomancer who's this woman who was a PR executive. And she showed up, I believe, in Archer and Armstrong Volume 2 is where she gets the powers. And the Eternal Enemy is coming for again. The Eternal Warrior decides to call in these sort of heroes to try and protect her. He calls in Bloodshot, who is one of their main sort of military heroes. He's a guy who has nanites in his blood, who can control technology, who can regenerate from almost anything. Very much almost Deadpool-esque set of powers.
Yeah, Deadpool, but mixed with a very Frank Castle mentality.
Yeah, he's a military dude.
It's like if Punisher had some kind of powers added
to
his name.
Yeah, and he sets Bloodshot to protect this Geomancer, while the Eternal Warrior rounds up literally every Valiant hero. Ninjak and the Harbingers and all this kind of stuff.
That actually sounds like a potentially good way to kind of get to know them as a group.
Yeah, to try and take down this eternal enemy. And that's what this is about. It's got some horror leanings because Jeff Lemire's writing it. And he, of course, did Swamp Thing and some of that stuff. If you liked his Swamp Thing, this feels of a piece with that. It's got some great creepy stuff. It's got some great action. And Paolo Rivera does amazing artwork.
More recently, of course, Jeff Lemire wrote Descender,
which we all really like. This is a really fun, it's a self-contained story. The four issues comprise the entire story. It does lead into a Bloodshot Reborn series, which I also really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick, you said you also read the first volume of Bloodshot.
Right.
Which is by Dwayne Sierzynski.
And art by, I forget who.
Barry Kitson's on there.
Right, Barry Kitson was on there.
But it's not him, sorry, Barry Kitson's on Harbinger. Garcia is the name. Manuel Garcia.
I think when I first got introduced to Valiant, Bloodshot was one of the characters I gravitated to.
I loved Bloodshot in the 90s.
Just an interesting character. Here, they kind of... I felt really bad for him right off the bat.
Yeah.
Because it's essentially him getting like his mind messed with the entire time.
Yeah, he goes out on missions for him. They give him this imaginary backstory where he's a military guy with a family at home that he's doing all this to protect them.
Whatever backstory is needed to basically make him do the job he needs to do.
That's a little bit of a spin on like what they were doing in Dollhouse from Whedon.
Yeah, because basically the fact is they just wipe his mind whenever they need and give him a new backstory. And so he gets wise to this and sort of escapes Project Rising Spirit, which is the covert unit he's been working for. And he's going after Harbingers, which are sort of the psionic power powered kids in this universe. And he's like their boogeyman because they've been using him for years to keep tabs on him and take him out.
The sequence with him sort of annihilating an entire underground city was just a little gruesome.
Yeah.
But it were scenes like that actually had a little bit more weight to them that I was very intrigued by. And sort of seeing this and then seeing him in the Valiant definitely makes me want to read Bloodshot Reborn because of sort of the things that occur.
What I think is interesting about Bloodshot, he really feels like if this was in the 90s, Schwarzenegger would be playing this character in the movie.
Yeah, it's true.
He feels like a Schwarzenegger type character.
Or a
Van Damme or one of those guys. Yeah, he's a military badass, but he's got a soft heart for kids, basically.
I always had a... In their original incarnation, I had kind of a thing for Archer and Armstrong.
Yeah.
The sort of, immortal kind of wise-ass kind of guy and slacker. And slightly older guy, like 40 or something like that. And the sort of young at the time, he was like from a cult. I don't know if they changed that.
No. Master that's Archer, still there.
Yep. Known as Archer. And their kind of unusual friendship and camaraderie. And it was just a cool team. Have you read that one yet, Rick?
Yes.
Does it go over all right?
Yeah, I like that one as well.
Did they change it up much?
No, a lot of it is pretty straightforward. Hard drinking immortal, and he is, of course, the enemy of the cult.
Right.
The immortal enemy of the cult, and they all hate him, and Archer, has a sort of a meet cute where he tries to kill him.
Yep.
I have to ask, because there's one of these books in here that I know is, like, the original one is one of your favorite books.
Yeah.
It's Quantum and Woody.
Yes.
How is this kind of...
Okay, well, I was going to save some of the stuff for next time, because we've watched a lot, we've read a lot of stuff, and I'd like you guys to at least read some of it before we get there, but I did really like Quantum and Woody.
Okay.
So next time out, I may talk about some of my notable favorites.
And I will read some more this week.
Cool. Yeah, we'll be back with more of that, and we're going to have, we have the volume ones on these. If there's ever anything you're interested in these, we can always special order them. We're going to try and get sort of a Valiant section going in the store to sell some of these and give people a chance to check them out. I've been pretty impressed with what I've read so far.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, one of the things Valiant was known for in the 90s was sort of a certain level of, like, just really good consistency.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, one of the problems with Marvel and DC sometimes is that as they change off writers, you get some, like, rather severe highs and lows.
Yeah.
And Valiant seemed to be more even-handed about that.
Yeah.
Almost, not creator-owned type of quite even, but yeah, an overall level of quality sort of was more sustained.
Yeah. And that's definitely something they've got going there. They've been going for about 3 years since the relaunch. There's a fair amount of stuff. And I've been finding as I read it, there's some nice interconnectivity, but there's also there's never a sense where I'm reading it like, oh, I don't know what's going on here because I didn't read this book.
It's more like it's the fun connectivity.
Yeah, it's the fun connectivity.
Like, oh, I know who the Geomancers are because, you know, of what was going on in this, or the Harbingers, and
right.
You know, I know a bit more of this story than was hinted at here.
Right, exactly. All right, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo-Jo!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.